Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Thinking big thoughts, so you don't have to.
You betcha.
Here's John Williams.
What they ask us to do. Let's see if we can. It's 109. It's John in the Allstate Showcase Studio on Michigan Avenue. You can join us on the phone. You can text us, too. The number doesn't change. 312-981-7200. Yada, 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 yada. So, Kim, as you well know, the internets and the interwebs are buzzing about a bunch of things today, and included among them are Donald and Ivanka's Trump's visit to North Dakota yesterday. He fawned over her, revealed that she still calls him daddy, and invited her to speak. "Hello, North Dakota," she said. I don't know what you say about this. As adults, do you still use the language of your youth to talk to your parents? What do you call your folks? What do you call your, what do your kids call you? I asked that on my Facebook page. I do not refer to my wife, Brenda, as mom when describing her to our kids. I never say, "Ask mom." I will always say, and I make a point of this to my sons. They don't know this because I don't make a point of making a point of it. But the truth is that I'll say, "Ask your mother," but I never say, "Ask mom." Brenda's not my mom, and I hate to see that line blurred. Do you know what I mean?
Yes. I know what you're saying.
And maybe some women appreciate that. Maybe some women don't care. But it's always been an issue for me. I don't say ask mom. I say ask your mother. Just a little. It's not even a point.
Why does that bother you?
Because it probably shouldn't. That is, if it doesn't bother Brenda, then why should it bother me? But Brenda's not my mother.
Right.
I would not say ask, because it also, to me, then categorizes my wife as just this unit. She's the mom unit. She's the mother of us. And for all of us to refer to her as the same thing takes away her individuality. It takes away her femininity. It takes away the fact that she's my wife. She's not my mother. I love my mom, too. But
well, no, I agree.
These are different creatures.
She's not your mom. But, I mean, to me, like, if my husband says to me, "Oh, just ask your mom," or "ask mom," to me, that's just conversational.
It doesn't bother me. And I know this is me way out there in the
And
weeds.
I hear people say, like, when I say somebody says, "Well, ask your mother," or "talk to your father," I hear that a lot of times with divorce couples, because they don't want to say, "Well, ask your mom," you know, "ask mom," because it's not.
Our relationship is different.
So if my husband said, like, "Ask your mother," that would like be like, what?
Uh-oh.
You know, like, what are you talking about?
Well, somebody's in trouble or I'm in trouble.
Right. You know, it's kind of would be weird, because to me it's just conversational to say, "Well, go ask mom."
I never say that. And you're not wrong. Trust me. I think I've, as I often do.
I think you're overthinking this one. Yes.
You got that right. But I'm telling you, I haven't shared this with the kids. I think Brendan knows I feel this way, but it's just, this is my own little personal thing. And so when I see Ivanka Trump refer to her father as daddy, you know, I don't know how he refers to her. Maybe they've got pet names. Maybe they've got the same names that they called each other when she was young. And you know, and he refers to her similarly. Everybody has their own thing. I don't think there's a right or wrong on this. I think we're all judging that word daddy. And you get to if you want. But I'm just telling you, we all have our own issues about
right. And that did sound a little creepy. I mean, I heard it. But I have to say, from like me growing up, because I grew up in the South, like my mom says that all the time. Ask daddy. It's a Southern thing. I mean, this Ivanka thing is different. But I always refer to my dad as dad. But my mom, it's just, I think there's this part of a Southern way you speak. And my mom always says daddy. Even she always said daddy when she was older.
People have seized on the word daddy. To me, the thing that just made me uncomfortable about that conversation on stage was how condescending or patronizing it was.
Absolutely.
I mean, maybe daddy is part of that package, but it's the tone. It's about it's the braggadociousness of the father who is so proud of his daughter that he just can't wait to wheel her out there the way, say, some parents do to their kids when they learn to play the piano. You know, hey, Billy, sit down and play the piano for the Johnsons. Listen to this kid play the piano. And he is just so appreciative, famously so, awkwardly so. He is so appreciative of her beauty. If you want to get uncomfortable about something that Donald Trump has for his daughter, get uncomfortable about that. But this thing, you know, doesn't bother me so much for the word daddy as sort of just the braggadociousness of it or the condescension in it all. But I'm telling you, if you go down that road, you're going to be sorry because she may not be the only adult daughter in America who refers to her father the same way she did as a little kid. I watch Arrested Development. They still call the father figure or the grandfather figure in that show Pop-Pop. I mean, who calls as an adult another adult Pop-Pop unless that's what you called your father as a child, and you still do? I'm similarly particular about my dogs. Brenda will say hello, will say to Bingo, the hunchback wiener dog that I push around in the G7 action stroller, now with mesh canopy. Brenda will say to Bingo, go see daddy. And I'm like, no, I am not Bingo's daddy. I will say, we are the dog's owners. We are not the dog's parents. So if I do speak English to my dogs, and I'm not sure that that's real productive, but I will say, go see Brenda. Or, hey, Brenda's home. I do not say your mother is home. I don't say mommy.
Okay, I'm with you on that. People get a little very...
baby talk to their pets.
Yeah, baby talk to the pets, I can't stand.
Let's
not
be doing that, okay? No. And again, I think I'm an outlier on this. We love our pets. We love to baby our pets. We love to, you know, treat them the way that we wouldn't our kids because it's even more fun to spoil your pets. I get it. But I don't say, go see mommy. I don't say, hey, mommy's home.
I'm not a fan of that either.
Thank you.
It's just weird. It's an animal.
Now, another dog out there could say, hey, mommy's home. Maybe like this, mommy's home. But adult humans don't get to say that about their pets because they're not their pets' parents. I call my parents mom and dad. I never use their first names. Some of you are comfortable with that in your adult and child relationship. Maybe you graduate from that into, you know, using their first names after you reach a certain age. So they were always mom and dad. But then when you hit 26 and you came home from college or somewhere and you said, hey, Lois, and there was probably a raised eyebrow. I mean, they had to notice it, but maybe you transition, although I don't know that you do. I think if you always called your parents mom and dad, don't you always call them mom and dad, even though you're now 57? That relationship sort of never changes. Sometimes I will use my dad's nickname and call him Bucky. My dad's nickname was Bucky, and I never would have called my dad Bucky when I was 16, but at some point I became more comfortable with that. And sometimes I'll say, hey, Buck, hey, Bucky. And sometimes I will affectionately call my mom Moose. I don't know why I do that, but I believe my dad once kiddingly referred to her as, hey, Moose. My mom is anything but a moose, and every now and then I'll say, hi, Moose, or hello, Moose. She doesn't seem to mind. She may. Maybe I should bring that up with her. I don't know. So that's where my head is today. In a little bit, we'll talk about the hurricane, where it is and what it means. We'll talk to an ABC Capitol Hill reporter. Lana Zak will join us at 2 to catch us up on the Russian investigation. And for that matter, the president's cooperative attitude with the Democrats. That's good for everybody. The Russians placing ads on Facebook or using hashtags to generate controversy is our 2:30 subject. Hey, Mike, it's John. You're on WGN. What did you want to say?
Hey, John. Nice talking to you. Before I get to the Donald Trump issue, as you were going along there, you can call your kid, you just said you called your dad a nickname. It's still a name. Yeah. It's still, whether it's a nickname or his actual name, it's kind of splitting hairs, I guess. But
I know. I'm not saying I'm consistent, logical, or normal about any of this.
Yeah. But the Ivana or Ivanka and Donald Trump thing, I go back to the TV show That Girl with Marlo Thomas. And her character always called her dad Daddy. Oh, Daddy, blah, 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 whatever.
Oh, wow.
No, nobody thought of anything then.
No.
The only problem is if Melania starts calling Donald Daddy, then I have an issue.
And some couples do that. And some couples
oh, yeah,
will say, hey, Daddy. And it's their right. And it's their husband, and I'm just like, no, I can't do that. Can't do that.
Yeah. No, that's when I cringe. Yeah, I'm with you on that.
I appreciate the call, Mike. Thanks for joining us. By the way, Mark Baser from the interview show you see on Channel 11, WTTW, Chicago, and he also does his show at the Hideout. That's where they tape it. Has just walked by our showcase studio on Michigan Avenue.
Hey, John.
What's going on?
I'm back to playing basketball here.
Yeah.
Back to missing every single shot.
Yeah, I know.
Back to feeling terrible about myself at noon every day. It's not good. It's not good.
That's so very Mark Baser of you. By the way, do you have a show coming up? I sent you an email today.
One. Did you? I have one tomorrow.
That's what I thought. You've got a show at the Hideout again.
I do.
Is it sold out?
It is.
Ah, is that why you weren't hitting me up for a free interview?
Kind of.
Mark's always, hey, John, how are you? Hey, John, what's going on? Hey, I got a show coming up. And I always say, oh.
Well, 2 days before I reach out, yeah.
Yeah, but you didn't reach out to me
No.
I'm happy for you.
I was feeling good about myself till the basketball. So.
Who's on your show at the Hideout?
John Green, who wrote The Fault in Our Stars.
Good Lord,
he's got a new one out. Steve James, who directed Life Itself. About Roger Ebert, The Interrupters, Hoop Dreams.
Yeah.
John Langford, who's a musician who is in the Mekons. He's got a new record out. It's all people who've been on. It's kind of like a summer booking show. Just call up people I know.
Sounds like a good one to me.
Yeah.
Wow.
So I'm looking forward to it. Yeah. You coming?
Well, it's sold out.
I can hook you up.
You normally give me tickets when you need something.
You're always on the list.
All right.
You're always on the list.
Tomorrow night.
Tomorrow night.
Let me know. Well, I'll be in touch. Good to see you, Mark.
See you, John.
Might want to dry your hair. Okay. There he goes. It's 1:20. More of your phone calls in a minute. This is WGN.
We're one of peace. That also means confronting those such as the Iranian regime.
President Trump is speaking right now, holding a news conference. He'll probably take some questions in a few minutes. We'll listen in on that.
Kuwait has never been stronger. Never, ever.
He's visiting with the Emir of Kuwait right now. That's who's on the stage with him there at the White House.
Expanding our counterterrorism and intelligence.
So the president is speaking, and then the way it usually goes is two questions for the president, two questions for the guest, and then all hell breaks loose. We'll see what happens in just a few minutes on that. After 1:30, by the way, we'll visit with Walter Ashley again, the Northern Illinois University professor and meteorologist. He was really good the other day talking about how cities like Houston and Miami are ill-prepared for storms like this. We got to start paying attention to this. I've got a couple of other questions for him about what's happening with Irma. Literally, do you find yourself going back to, I don't know, CNN or wherever you go just to see where is it now? Where is it now? What happened now? Still 180-mile-an-hour winds. We'll say hello to him in about 15 minutes. Sue, this is John. You're on WGN. What do you want to say?
Hi, John. First of all, it's great to hear your voice back in Chicago again.
Thank you. Thank you. It's good to be back.
Yeah, it's just great to turn on the radio and hear that voice. I hate to agree with anything the Trumps do. Really bothers me. But I called my dad Daddy until the day he died, and I refer to him as Daddy. I'm 75 years old, and I still, when I refer to my dad, it's my daddy.
Yeah.
I don't know why that is, but, and my kids, my grandkids named my husband Pabo early on because they couldn't pronounce Papa Bob, which is what he wanted to be called, and we all called him Pabo for as long as he lived. Called him Pabo. It just, you know, it's an endearment, and, you know, I don't know. I kind of disagree with you on this one.
No, that's...
I really think... You know, whatever you want to call the person, the people in your life, is okay. And so if Ivanka wants to call Daddy, Daddy, it's okay with me. So they get 1 point from me.
Well, it's about time we gave them a point, isn't it, Sue?
Right. Absolutely. And that's the first one they've gotten from me. So.
Thanks for the call.
Sure enough.
Well, the Trumps are trending up in some unusual circles. I mean, look at what the president did with Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi. Paul Ryan went, "Are you, excuse me? You just said what? We're going to do what?" Boy, did he drop a bombshell on them when they were talking about the debt ceiling and about hurricane relief funding. The president did what exactly you and I would do if we were not political creatures. You would just bring both sides in, you'd listen, you go, oh, well, this is easy. This is why I want to be king someday. I always say a lot of these things are really easy to manage if you don't try and manage it as a political lever, right? So if you'd say, well, what should we do? It's going to cost the people hundreds of billions of dollars to figure out Houston. Let's give them $8 billion of federal money. Let's just approve it. You and I would go, yeah, let's just do it. And then somebody else would say, well, let's attach it to the wall or let's make it part of the DACA negotiation or something. Go, no, don't do that. Don't do that. Let's just give it to them. Okay, but then what about this debt ceiling thing? We got to raise that. And you or I might say, well, let's... The Democrats want 90 more days. The Republicans want a little bit more. But 90 days, we ought to be able to figure. Let's just do those two things. Boom. I can figure that out right now. Problem solved. And the Republicans in the room are like, Mr. President, we're all on the same team here, even if that's the logical thing to do. And maybe it's not, but we got to stick together. And that we got to stick together stuff is the stuff that makes all of us crazy. And Trump is so indifferent to that. You know he doesn't like Democrats, but he's not crazy about Republicans either. So he just said, I'm just going to do this. He turned to Mitch McConnell and said, you're fired. And that was the end of the conversation. And this feels weird, but I'm like, okay, all right then. Now, if he tries to use that as his own kind of leverage, that is, circulating on the interwebs today is the picture of Chuck Schumer and President Trump looking glowingly at each other. The last time you saw two men gaze that happily at each other, one of them was Mike Pence. But there they were, both on the same team. And if the president now thinks that he's due some payback for this kindness that he's shown them, well, now that'll be interesting to see how that plays out. Does he now say, okay, so about my little wall here? I mean, can you see him just saying, oh, come on, let me nuke North Korea? Oh, okay. But thank you for the thing on the debt ceiling or whatever. So it'll be interesting to see, you know, what chits he thinks he has in his hand now. That'll come down the road. It's 1:29. We'll do the news here in a couple of seconds and then talk to a really smart meteorologist right after that. The Northern Illinois University professor and meteorologist. Thanks for joining us again. You're on WGN. How are you?
I'm well. How are you, John?
Good. Just in general, what's your reaction to what's happening with Irma right now?
Well, we've just got the morning suite of models in, the numerical models that we use to forecast, and I got to be honest with you, it looks catastrophic or potentially catastrophic for Southeast Florida, which of course includes the Miami-Fort Lauderdale metropolitan area, but even sliding up the coast as far as Jacksonville, and then potentially a secondary landfall near Savannah, Georgia, and possibly as far east as Charleston, South Carolina. So this is one of those, I think, unfortunate events that's going to be unfolding over the next 3 to 4 days that may make history.
Why do you say catastrophic?
The development. The development up along really all the coastline from the Keys stretching to as far north as Jacksonville. The entire coastline is for the most part developed and has seen an explosion in development, particularly in the last 2 to 3 decades. So there's hundreds of billions of dollars in property and, of course, lives that are going to be exposed to this potentially catastrophic Category 4 or 5 hurricane when it makes landfall.
Is it pretty certain that that's what it's going to do, Miami and then up the eastern seaboard the way I described?
Yeah, the certainty has coalesced. Again, as we get closer to a potential landfall, our certainty gets, we get more confidence. And in this particular instance, the models are coalescing around a southeast Florida landfall. I will say that there is a possibility that this could still sweep just a hair east of Miami and Fort Lauderdale and spare them the worst. But it really is just a jog of 20 or 30 miles that can make all the difference between, say, a $10 billion storm and a $200 to $300 billion storm. So we are on pins and needles here trying to nail down this forecast.
The damage we've seen on some of the smaller islands is catastrophic, but if it hits the mainland of the United States, I assume those buildings are better built. We wouldn't see that sort of destruction, right?
They are better built, but there's a heck of a lot more of them, particularly the southeastern shore of Florida is mostly high-rise developments, condos and apartments and so forth. And just inland from there, there's large mobile home communities. We saw destruction of many mobile home communities in Hurricane Andrew in the 1990s. So we're fearful of not only those people along the coastline and the infrastructure there, but just inland. Obviously, a mobile home cannot withstand the wind, say, that a large steel and concrete structure would.
I'm going to call this one a Category 6 because Category 5 is 157 miles an hour. This one's over 180. It seems at some point they ought to give 5 plus some other indication that this is not a run-of-the-mill Category 5.
Well, I think we've, you know, oftentimes focused too much on the categories, and we've seen minimal hurricanes, even tropical storms, which are less than category one hurricane status, inflict tens of billions of dollars of damage and kill lots of folks. So focusing solely on the intensity and not taking into account the bathymetry, which is what is the land underneath the water look like, whether or not you're talking about a bay or estuary, or more importantly, the elevation of the land that will be impacted, and naturally the development therein, those have huge consequences for the disaster that might be unfolding.
So I follow Progress Polls, which is, I think, conservative polling site on Twitter, and they tweeted yesterday, are these hurricanes due to global warming or just Mother Nature? And then you can click global warming or you can click Mother Nature. And hundreds of people have retweeted this, and hundreds of people are liking it, and thousands of people are voting on it as though it was one of two options. This is global warming or it's Mother Nature. I'm a little ticked at the question itself, but I thought I would just mention that to you and get your reaction.
Well, you're a professional. As you know, framing the question is quite critical, and that dichotomy is not correct. We know what the basic ingredients are necessary to create a hurricane, typically very warm water, a lack of wind shear, a change in wind direction and speed with height in the atmosphere, and just a thunderstorm complex that sustains itself that allows the Earth's rotation to impart a circulation. Those are basic fundamental ingredients that have been there for ages, before humans. The framing of the climate change, climate change shouldn't be thought of as a cause, but rather as a contributor, a possible contributor to the frequency and ultimately the magnitude of these events. And obviously, we've invested a lot of time and effort into researching that question, and the evidence suggests that as we move throughout this century, that the storm frequency in the North Atlantic Basin will stay about the same. But the overwhelming evidence at this point is that these storms will potentially get stronger, which makes sense under a global warming scenario. You increase the temperature of the oceans. These storms feed off of that. So there's that potential for increased magnitudes.
Is that it? The temperature of the water is what drives a hurricane as opposed to, I don't know, the temperature of the air or the wind speed aloft or something like that?
It's exactly that. It's like we need food for sustenance as humans. Well, hurricanes need warm ocean water, typically greater than 80 degrees. And in some parts of the Caribbean, and unfortunately where Irma's getting ready to roll over, the waters are approaching 90 degrees Fahrenheit. So we're really talking about bath water here, and they feed off of that.
Really? The water is that warm? I mean, I know that's a warm water place, but that's bizarre. I just swam in Lake Michigan the other day. It was not 90 degrees. It's amazing. Wow. Okay, so, but I mean, then that almost makes it sound inevitable that as we have hurricanes, with the water temperature getting warmer, they're almost absolutely always going to be some measure stronger than they would have otherwise been, right?
And that's a concern. But, you know, that is what we're thinking. We're doing more and more simulations on this, and there's lots of great scientists working on this kind of critical problem. But, you know, again, I go back to the argument that it only really takes one storm. Andrew is a good example of that. You know, Sandy, unfortunately, as we'll see with Harvey and Irma, it takes one storm to hit a highly developed region, global warming or no global warming, to inflict, unfortunately, tens of billions of dollars in losses and lots of loss of life.
Well, how unusual is it to have something like Harvey followed immediately by something like Irma, a 4 and a 5 or 2 fours? I mean, what do you think of that?
You don't have to go back too far. 2004 and 2005 are good examples of repeated hurricanes tracking across the North Atlantic Basin. Most people know Katrina in 2005. A lot of people forget about Rita and subsequent storms that came that year. In fact, we went through the entire alphabet and had to start going into our Greek alphabet. So that was it's not unprecedented.
Well, you may be answering my question, but I wasn't talking about the number of them, but how you would have consecutive really strong ones. But those were tough years, huh?
That's a little unusual, but again, 2004 and 05, we did have subsequent storm, intense storms. It is unusual, and it's something that we find quite scary.
So what do you think about the rainfall then associated with this? That was what did Houston in. Are they going to get this kind of rainfall in Miami and up the coast?
So every tropical system is a very efficient producer of precipitation. If you've ever lived through one, you know that it produces amazing amounts of rainfall. This one isn't going to be exactly like Harvey. Harvey stalled generally right over Houston, as we know. This one is going to be a little bit more progressive and move through the peninsula fairly quickly and then up into Georgia and Carolinas and dissipate thereafter. At least we hope so. So the fact that it's moving at a relatively good clip will restrict some of the flooding, but there's still the rainfall totals are expected to be between 10 and 15 inches across the Florida peninsula.
Boy, Houston would have given its left arm for that.
Exactly.
10 or 15 versus 40 or 50 inches. And then I understand there's a couple more hurricanes that are brewing out in the ocean. Is that true?
Yeah, this is, again, a little bit of an unusual spot. Well, the one we've been in before, but we have Katy in the western Gulf of Mexico that will eventually make landfall in eastern Mexico this weekend. We have, of course, Irma, which is the big news item right now, but also Jose, which is unfortunately headed right for the area that was impacted a couple of days ago by Irma, the Lesser Antilles, which received catastrophic damage. It looks like they're going to be impacted by Jose again.
Does that mean that will also track up towards Miami then?
The forecast for Jose is looks like it after it affects the Lesser Antilles, hopefully. We hope, and based on the forecast, looks like it'll be a fish storm. So it appears to be dissipating south of Bermuda.
And then do you know what follows Jose? J, K, is there a K out there?
Oh yeah. Well, Katy is the one in the Western Gulf right now. So the season is, we're just in the mature part of the season, and hurricane season extends all the way through early December.
My number is 312-981-7200 if you have a question or a comment about this. Hurricanes, you're for them, you're against them. I'm against them. Did we have a big hurricane season last year? Were we talking about this that much?
No, I think that's, it really is a matter of whether it has that potential to impact people and land. It's been, for the last 10 to 12 years, since 2004, 2005, somewhat of generally lackluster years in terms of the frequency. And that's a great thing for folks living along the coastline. But unfortunately, we know that can't sustain itself. So we're flipping back into a fairly active pattern. But we can't go back too far, and we all remember Hurricane Sandy that impacted the eastern seaboard not too many years ago.
We don't have to debate climate change. I think that conversation isn't all that beneficial anymore. But when we go through a couple of seasons without strong hurricanes, then people say, aha, see, so where's your hurricanes then? I thought the weather was going to be more severe. Well, what do you make of that kind of dialogue when you hear that?
I hate to say ignorance, but that's what I would come at it. I would invite people to become a little bit more informed about climate change. Climate change is just more than hurricanes or tornadoes or the hazards that we see front and center. I think the most pressing item that when we talk about climate change is sea level rise. And that's a slow creeping hazard that takes decades to occur. And will have huge ramifications, not only, of course, for the United States, but for the entire globe. Increasing heat waves and increasing droughts and also increasing frequency of high magnitude flood events. Those are all things that we're seeing occur and are forecast to get worse as we go through the 21st century. So I just would invite people to to look at sources of information and become a little bit more informed. Don't just believe everything that you see on social media.
Well, especially, you know, it's funny you mention that, because later on we're going to talk about how the Russians in the last election were putting things out on the internet. On Facebook, it would appear innocuous enough. Somebody said, hey, look at this article on some what appears to be a legitimate website about the politicians. And people would share it, and a hashtag evolves, and the next thing you know, everybody's sharing something like it's fact, and it was something the Russians planted. We know that now. And you go, so we have to be careful about that. I guess we have to, about weather issues as well. That is, get informed, get credible sources, and then pay attention to it. I have a question for you about what's going on in Los Angeles as well, and San Francisco, and the weather out there. Give me one more minute, Professor. Walker Ashley is on the phone from Northern Illinois University. Time for a couple questions for our guest. First, give me 30 seconds to tell you about Midwestern University. The Midwestern University Multi-Specialty Clinic in Downers Grove offers a comprehensive patient-centered healthcare experience at their family medicine clinic, speech-language institute, physical therapy institute, dental institute, eye institute. At their clinics, you'll receive quality care from a team of highly qualified faculty and students. Learn more at MWUClinics.com or call 630-743-4500, 630-743-4500. Midwestern University Clinic is your family's home for health care. Walker Ashley from Northern Illinois University is on the phone. We're talking weather with him as we have the last couple of days. He is a consulting meteorologist there and a professor of, did you also say geography, Walker?
Yes, I have a background in geographic science as well.
Lots of questions for you. Let's just get a couple of them before you run to class. Kim asked this question. I can see it on the screen. Do you believe that there's any chance this thing will go inland across the state? Is it certain or almost certain that it's going to stay on the coast and go north?
That's the question, right? Our certainty is growing. As a meteorologist, we always have an element of uncertainty. We're talking about a very complex system. In fluid dynamics, it's very hard to model. But we're getting more confident with a southeast landfall. The latest European model does bring it a little bit further inland, so it brings it through Miami and then up towards between Orlando and Tampa. But again, focusing on the track is maybe the wrong thing to do. The storm is quite large and will impact all of South and Central Florida.
Here's another question from Trish. You're on WGN. Trish, what can we do for you? Hi.
Hey, John, love your show. Glad you're back.
Thank you.
I have a question. I remember after Katrina taking a trip to the Gulf area. Are these people going to be at an increased risk for red tide after these storms?
I don't know what a red tide is.
Isn't it a flower that blooms out into the ocean and after storms it stirs it up and causes a lot of respiratory distress and all sorts of good things that brings it closer to the shores?
How about that? What about that, Professor?
I wish I could answer that one, but that is beyond my level of expertise. I get a lot of questions about geology and meteors, and I have zero evidence of how that affects. But that's a great question.
Yeah, okay. Well, we'll follow it. Let's go to Tom. You're on WGN. Thank you, Trish. Tom, you're on the air. What can we do for you?
The planet is 4.5 billion years old. So without certainty, the climate has and will always change. That's 100% certainty. My question is, when humans started contributing toward carbon in the atmosphere by burning fossil fuels, that was only in the 1800s. So what year, and I know you're not advocating this, but for some of the people that almost treat this like a political or religious question, what year or what decade did our supposed contribution of carbon in the atmosphere from burning fossil fuels start to take effect? And
okay, hold on, Tom. We got your question. I want to let him answer before he has to run to class. Do you want to comment on that, Professor?
Yeah, it's been a slow climb. It isn't a year or a specific point in time. It's been a slow contribution of carbon dioxide to the atmosphere. And it's just not carbon dioxide. It's methane and so on and so forth. These are greenhouse gases, and the physics is fairly straightforward. And the issue is, of course, we haven't reduced that input into the atmosphere.
How extraordinary is what's going on in California right now before you go? The temperatures are through the roof over there.
It is it is extremely extraordinary. It has occurred before. There are certainly records being broken. But what we foresee is that these are going to occur with more frequency. And as we know, they often have consequences such as raging forest fires or the heat waves that we've seen.
I'll talk to you again another day. Thank you, Walker.
Thank you, John. Have a good one.
Yeah, you too. Walker Ashley from Northern Illinois University.
Thinking big thoughts so you don't have to. Here's John Williams.
Yeah, well, you know, sometimes I farm that out. We got a good guest right around the corner. In fact, in about, 19 seconds, it's 207.
Lord have mercy.
This is John Williams in the Allstate Showcase Studio on Michigan Avenue. And we're here all the way until 3. Rokon, Anna DeBlantis, ready to entertain you in about 45 minutes or so. Here we go. Donald Trump Jr. told Congress, I guess, that he was interested in taking that meeting with the Russians to ascertain Hillary Clinton's, quote, fitness and character. He wanted to see if there was something there, and you can't know until you take the meeting. At least that's what I understand to be his testimony, not before U.S. senators, they were able to listen, but Senate staffers. I'm a little intrigued by how that meeting even takes place. To talk a little bit about that is Lana Zach. She's the ABC News Capitol Hill reporter, and she joins us on WGN Radio. Lana, it's John. How are you this afternoon?
Hey, John. It's great to be with you and everybody out there in Chicago.
Where are you right now?
I'm actually currently in the Senate at the moment, where Donald Trump Jr. Responded to requests by the Senate Judiciary Committee to come answer some more questions about his involvement with a meeting that he had with a Russian lawyer that promised to have dirt on Hillary Clinton, his father's main opponent for the presidency. And and part of what, this was an interesting thing from the very beginning. Instead of coming in the entrance that he was planned to come in, he was sort of squirreled away. We believe that it may have been through some loading bays in order to make it without any cameras or anything catching him actually here in the Capitol. Some folks calling it a Houdini act, but he showed up here at the Senate and has been answering questions for hours now.
To Senate staffers, but not U.S. senators, was Dick Durbin, for instance, who I believe is on that committee that would actually question him, was Dick Durbin listening in on this, or how did that all take place?
Well, as I understand it, some senators and Senate staffers are in there. The meeting was formally called by the Judiciary Committee. It is a working day, so what normally happens in these types of situations, senators and their staffers will come in and out depending on votes and other meetings and work that they have to do. But again, John, this is all closed door. As much as it was secret him getting in, so much of the details of what's actually happening behind those closed doors are secret as well.
Well, is this part of the Mueller investigation, or I guess the Senate investigation?
That's an excellent question. Let's go ahead and clarify that. Mueller's FBI-led investigation is independent of what Donald Trump Jr. is doing right now before the Senate Judiciary Committee. This is his first time that he is facing congressional investigators who are looking into allegations of Russian meddling in the last election. Mueller is pursuing his own path, and though they have similar topics, what he's doing right now is not at the request of the FBI.
What Donald Trump Jr. is doing is not at the request of the FBI.
Right. His current testimony is not at the request of the FBI.
But I wonder what the purpose of this is then, or the value of this is then. What happens with this information?
Well, as you know, the Senate is performing its own investigation. The House has an investigation. But the ultimate authority on this is going to be Robert Mueller and the FBI. So in some ways, this is the Senate being interested in knowing what's happened. And as Judiciary Committee members, they are certainly entitled to ask these questions and to ask folks like Donald Trump Jr. to come before them and answer these questions, clarify their remarks as part of their fact-finding mission. But this isn't the big investigation that has dominated so much of the discussion.
And so Donald Trump Jr. presumably would have to testify before Mueller and company as well then, right?
That's right.
So he issues a statement, though, where he said, as I said in the run-up to you, that he was there to ascertain her fitness and character. To the extent that they had information concerning the fitness, character, or qualifications of a presidential candidate, I believe that I should at least hear them out. He issued in a statement, depending on what, if any, information they had, I could then consult with counsel to make an informed decision as to whether to give it further consideration. What do you make of that?
Well, what emerges in the prepared remarks that Donald Trump Jr. presented before the committee is more of a it's almost a snapshot of the campaign during the time, and the way he's trying to explain that moment in time is that they were a campaign that didn't know what they were doing, that they were a bit disorganized in terms of who was leading the campaign. He mentions that they were just changing campaign managers, that he had never been involved in any of these things before, and so. He says he was trying to run the business at the same time. It was a chaotic time, and he wanted to ascertain Clinton's fitness for office. Now, that's not really his job, and what his whole we're going to see what they had to say, and then I'll consult with lawyers about it later. It's sort of an excuse of ignorance rather than one of actual criminal activity. That's the case that Donald Trump Jr. tries to make in the four pages of submitted testimony.
Well, they were busy savaging her character and fitness anyway. Remember the one time she stumbled and everybody was suddenly talking about her health, and they've always disparaged her character. She's a liar. She's crooked Hillary. So I think we all know how the Trump campaign felt about her fitness and her character.
Yeah, I think his altruistic desires to determine her fitness for the future of America may be a little overblown on that one. But
right.
Ultimately, what he's trying to say is, this person said they had dirt on the person my dad's running against for office, and I wanted to know if that dirt actually was going to stick.
I'm open to the question of, as a rookie, how apparent should it have been to him that when some Russian lawyers or operatives, whoever these people were in this room, if they say, hey, we got the goods on Hillary, we got dirt on her, boy, this is going to be bad for Hillary Clinton. Illogical is it that they would take that meeting, particularly since they're new to this game anyway? I suppose he could just throw a mea culpa out there and say, I didn't know that I should have told the FBI, or I shouldn't have taken a meeting like that.
And that's exactly right, John. And that's so much of what we see in this testimony that he submitted. But there are a couple problems with that. He, after they were elected, he failed to disclose that this meeting had taken place. He didn't say that he had met with this Russian lawyer. And then their initial response to it was to say that this was not really that. It was we didn't know that she had dirt. We were going to talk about Russian adoptions, and sort of obfuscating and trying to potentially mislead people about what was actually happening in that meeting, instead of just coming forward and saying, hey, I didn't know. We thought that that's what you do in an election,
which is perhaps
a more sympathetic position. But it just starts to smell a little stinky when you're not forthright from the beginning and say, as you did, John, that, you know, people make mistakes. And the American public tends to be very forgiving of people who say that.
Yeah, I'd be more likely to give them that than because to me, the idea that, hey, it turns out it was adoptions. There was nothing there. We didn't get any valuable information. There was a bait and switch. I don't see how that's persuasive for them, because the fact that there was no operational information for them doesn't change the fact that they took the meeting to get dirt on Hillary Clinton. I mean, that's the problem here. It's not what did they get. It's what did they think they were going to get? Why did they take the meeting? Am I right on that?
You're right. And also when Donald Trump Jr. released the email in its entirety with him and Rob Goldstein, it shows that he, in fact, thought that he was going to get dirt. And his response in email was, I love it. He tried to explain away his I love it today as well by saying that was just a colloquial way of thanking Rob for his email. But it's pretty obvious once he released that they, in fact, thought this meeting was potentially very damaging to Hillary Clinton and beneficial to his father's campaign, and that's why he took the meeting.
that meeting today with the Senate is on the record? I mean, can they use that for or against him down the road then?
My understanding is that he is under oath in this testimony, that he could be held liable if he lies to the Senate investigators. So certainly what he says needs to be conscious of that fact.
That's where any of us can get in trouble, and he has in the past, where you start to speak off the cuff. And I don't know if he had counsel with him while he was answering questions, somebody to guide him a little bit on what to say. But if he's, you know, untethered, kind of like his dad, you don't know what he's going to say.
Well, and he was asked one of the big questions right now about his father's response, or his father's involvement in crafting the initial response from Don Jr. about this meeting. That has become something that has become a big issue, in part because if the president of the United States did try and help his son mislead the American public, then that is a potentially greater problem than just Don Trump Jr. on his own trying to do this. So,
yeah, I never thought about it that way. When President Trump said, I did what anybody does for their kid, I help them out. If I craft a letter that misleads the people for Don Jr. to issue, then I've, in fact, as the president, misled the American people.
That's right. And so that's part of what folks like Mueller are going to be looking at very closely, and certainly will be part of that investigation. And so for Don Jr.'s part today, our understanding is that when he was asked questions about that, he simply said he did not recall. He did not recall how much the White House had been involved in crafting that response, because that's a safer answer than saying anything that can be proven false.
I'm not saying there's a cover-up, but it's always the cover-up, isn't it? You know, whatever you did, you'd better be honest about it after the fact, because if you're not, that's the crime that ends up putting people in jail or getting them to resign from office.
Mistakes can be forgiven, but lying to the face of the American public is a much more bitter pill to swallow.
Lana Zak is the ABC News Capitol Hill reporter. She's at the U.S. Senate today. Well, we'll visit again. I sure appreciate your time this afternoon.
Great to talk to you, John.
It's 2:19 on WGN. You know, this thing about, and I didn't ask her, but she said that this was a closed-door meeting. We actually don't have a transcript of what was said. But one wonders, too, if since we're talking today about the fact that some sort of Russian operatives maybe operating out of St. Petersburg were actually posting hashtags and stories or buying ads to sort of create controversy during the election. You kind of wonder if that came up as they were talking to him. Did he have any information or knowledge about that? Did that come up at the meeting or not? But how does that work anyway? Well, the New York Times wrote a long story about that today, and the reporter will join us after 2:30. This is WGN. You heard Ro Khan and Anna DeVlantis talk about their show, which comes up after 3. Ken Burns, the famous historian, is going to be on their show. Boy, am I jealous. Aren't we all big Ken Burns fans? Ken Burns did the Civil War documentary, and then he did baseball. And it's funny because people who really know about the Civil War, and particularly people who really know baseball, and they're out there, took issue with some of the things that Ken Burns said or did in the baseball series. They say, well, Ty Cobb did this or didn't do that, or somebody did Babe Ruth, or, you know, just walking through history. There are so many details and so much minutia and so much storytelling that it's inevitable that one of your facts is either going to be not right or right, but not exactly tell the whole story. And then people absolutely lose their mind about some things. And baseball is one of them. I'll bet the Civil War is too. Early American history, the Hamiltons and the Jeffersons and the Washingtons and the Franklins, those wonks. You get a detail wrong about them, trust me, I know a little bit about these things, and they're through the roof. Now imagine what it's like biting off the Vietnam War. They said that enough time has passed now that, you know, we really do need to sort of sit back and say what happened and why. How did Vietnam happen? How does it not happen again? Has it happened again? All of these questions. I can just imagine how difficult that story is to tell in a way that will please the largest number of people, if for nothing else, the facts. So I'm watching this little mini documentary about the making of the Ken Burns Vietnam series, which is about to debut on PBS. That's why Ken Burns is coming on with Ro and Anna. 18 hours. They've been working on it for years. And so they're telling the story about how they put the show together, this 18-hour docuseries. They said that, you know, they write this, they do an overview, and then they write the script, and they look at the archival photos and the video, you know, the film that's been transferred to video. They found things that, in fact, had never been found or seen before. And then they put together kind of a rough working version of it. And then they sit it down, sit Vietnam veterans down. They sit down people, Vietnamese soldiers. I don't know if they were Viet Cong, per se. I don't know what side they were fighting for. But you have Vietnamese in the room, and you have American veterans in the room. And they're all sitting down, and then there's Ken Burns. And he says, okay, we're going to show you what we've got so far. And in the little series, this little mini presentation of the making of it, Ken Burns says, now we are 2.5 years from the broadcast date. Here's what we've got. Tell us what you think. I was so impressed with that fact. I mean, think about that. So they had something that they were ready to show some people a couple of years ago, but they wanted to make sure they had it right. They don't want to find out the day after it airs that they got some detail wrong. So then there's the people afterwards, and some are saying, well, I think you should have focused more on these villages, or I think you need to tell the story this way, or maybe that one interview was skewed away that didn't strike me right. I was there. Here's what you should say. And they're dutifully taking notes and writing all of this down and then going back and editing it as they kind of work their way through a process that by that point was still pretty detailed, and they still had a couple more years to sort of refine it. They scored original music. There's Yo-Yo Ma talking about how they put together the music for some of it, and some of it was pre-recorded music from, or was music that had previously been composed, but was from Vietnam itself. The story is set in 1968. So they said, we're not going to get music from 1973, even though that was still of the era, but the music had to be right at the right time. And this went on about how they were telling the story. So Ken Burns is in town with Ro and Anna here in the studio. And then he's going over to the theater downtown, the amphitheater. It's not the amphitheater, the auditorium theater. Thank you, Ella. The auditorium theater, and he's giving a talk tonight. And I don't know if he's going to show any of it, but a friend of mine who's a Vietnam veteran and is himself a storied war hero. I won't get into the Jim Zwitt story, but it's an amazing thing. And if you want to read something that will just flabbergast you and make you cry, just Google Zwitt, Z-W-I-T, and Schmick, S-C-H-M-I-C-H. Mary Schmick wrote a story about Jim Zwitt, my neighbor and friend, and about his Vietnam War experience. It was one of the 10 stories that Mary Schmick submitted to the Pulitzer Committee that ultimately won her the Pulitzer Prize. Her telling of that story is just amazing. So Mr. Zwitt and a buddy of his and I and a whole bunch of people are going to be over at the theater watching Ken Burns speak this evening. And I'm really looking forward to what he's going to say and how he's going to say it. He's in town tonight. And the PBS series debuts later this month, I think, right? What's the broadcast date of that? Do you know off the top of your head, Elif?
Yeah, it's going to be next Sunday, the 17th.
Sunday night, yeah. Mm-hmm. And then 18 hours. And, you know, I don't know if that sounds like a burden to you, like, okay, I've got to go to class, and it's going to be 18 hours on the Vietnam War, or if you're really intrigued and leaning into it. I'm a little bit of both. It sounds like work. But the people who have watched it, including Matt Rausch from TV Guide, who was with us yesterday, said that for all of Labor Day weekend, he just sat down and watched all 18 hours. And he said that it just draws you in. You just get sucked into this thing. And it's pretty fantastic. So Ken Burns on with Ro and Anna a little after 3 here on WGN. And I'll have something to say about it tomorrow, too. It's 2:29. So Facebook may have been used by some Russians to stir up some sort of turmoil pre-election. We've been talking about that, it seems like, ever since the election, even beforehand. It was afterwards that we began to suspect that. Actually, I'm not sure what the timeline on that is. But here's a story in the New York Times, and it's absolutely fascinating as it describes one Melvin Reddick, of Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, a friendly-looking American with a backward baseball cap and a young daughter. He posted on Facebook a link to a brand-new website, quote, "These guys show hidden truth about Hillary Clinton, George Soros, and other leaders of the U.S., he wrote, June 8, 2016. Visit hashtag DC Leaks website. It's really interesting. The problem is no Melvin Reddick appears in Pennsylvania records, and his photos seem to be borrowed from an unsuspecting Brazilian. He may have been a concoction by the Russians to stir stuff up." Writing about this is Scott Shane in the New York Times today. It's utterly fascinating and kind of scary. Hey, Scott, you're on WGN in Chicago. Thanks for taking our call.
Thanks for having me on, John.
Dang. How long have you been working on this story? How much big picture do you know about this?
Well, I, with colleagues, wrote a story, a long story, about the actual hacking and leaking of documents and emails from Democratic targets in the election. And that story ran in December. And after that, I started looking at other aspects of what the Russians had been up to. And this actually proved to be much more elusive, because it's pretty tough to look at a Twitter account or look at a Facebook account and determine, you know, who put it together, whether the person is real. You kind of set out to prove that somebody doesn't exist. And that's a little bit nerve-wracking. You know, I'm quite confident that there is no Melvin Reddick in Pennsylvania who created that Facebook account. I think it was created by agents of the Russian government. But how can you be sure, you know? And I thought about, geez, if I write that and then Melvin calls me up,
well,
that will be a bad moment.
The Melvin Reddicks of the world, these maybe fictitious accounts that the Russians generated, what did they do with these accounts or these fictitious characters?
Some of it was what you might consider to be just, you know, fairly rabid political activism, you know, hashtag Clinton corruption, and, you know, just sort of spamming out to the world a message about politics. In other cases, in many cases, they were promoting their leaked documents. So there are a bunch of different sets of leaks that certainly the U.S. intelligence agencies have blamed the Russian government for, and they were promoting those leaks, you know, sort of throwing them out onto the internet, hoping that others pick them up. You know, I think the people who look at this say that the goal is always to use whatever fakery you might use to generate what they call, you know, organic activity and interest on Twitter or Facebook. In other words, make something go viral, step aside, and step aside and let other people who are quite sincere talk about it.
Well, he posted this. So somebody creates this account. They use this fictitious name and a bogus picture of a guy and his kid. And now it looks like somebody in Pennsylvania saying, "Hey, everybody, go to DC Leaks website." But there is a DC Leaks website. I went there today. So is DC Leaks then part of the Russian fabrication?
Yes, that's the conclusion of the U.S. intelligence agencies, which they put in their report in January, is that DCLeaks.com was created by agents of the Russian military intelligence, the agency called GRU, and was part of, you know, a fairly broad, multifaceted, quite determined information intervention, information attack on the U.S. election.
Yeah, well, your story today is going to really screw them. I mean, because I Googled DC Leaks and found quite recently people still referencing or going to DC Leaks for what appeared to be legitimate purposes, you know, inside scoop on politics. But now they're outed as just being this bogus Russian account, and nobody should be hashtagging them.
No, I mean, what's interesting is DC Leaks was a lot of these Russian personas, as they're called in the sort of cyber world, were created based on a successful existing model. So DC Leaks sort of presented itself as a new, more Washington-oriented version of WikiLeaks. And another of the Russian sites was a blog called Guccifer 2.0. And there had been a Romanian hacker who'd been prosecuted who called himself Guccifer. So there was that model. And Anonymous Poland presented itself as hackers in Poland, you know, based on the sort of global hacking group Anonymous. So the Russians seem to have taken a model for each of these. And then, you know, what they did with each of them is do a whole lot of Twitter activity to promote the site, to promote the documents that were leaked, and so on.
Did they ever refer people back to legitimate sites? I mean, you don't need DC Leaks if you've got, say, Breitbart. There's a lot of hostile information about Hillary before the election there. Were they doing that?
You know, there's been some of that. And one of the things that's so difficult at you know, about looking at the election is that there was obviously a tsunami of information, most of it being generated on social media, most of it being generated by sincere people who,
right,
you know, hated Trump and loved Clinton, or hated Clinton, loved Trump, or hated both of them.
Yeah.
And you know, so to find what, you know, what the Russians were up to in that sort of flood proved pretty difficult. And I would also say that I don't think the Russians in this case, in their use of Facebook and Twitter, added a huge percentage to all the stuff that was out there. But I think, you know, when you follow what they did, it looks very much like a series of experiments. And I think they are very into using information as a weapon. And I think we'll see them come back to social media, you know, for future U.S. elections.
Was their use of these hashtags and these fake sites always pro-Trump, or was it mixed, or was it neither?
I'd say it was overwhelmingly anti-Clinton. You saw a little bit of pro-Trump, but most of the Russian action was anti-Clinton, and that actually completely makes sense. Vladimir Putin, the Russian president, had explicitly blamed Hillary Clinton when she was Secretary of State for encouraging big demonstrations that took place against him and his government in 2011 in Moscow. Putin said, and maybe actually believed, that Clinton had somehow given a green light or given encouragement to these anti-Putin protests. He took that very personally. He also felt that the U.S., under the Obama administration, had encouraged anti-Russian actions in places like Georgia and Ukraine, and he felt the U.S. was sort of meddling in neighboring states to Russia, and, you know, he resented that deeply. So he definitely did not want Hillary Clinton to be president,
yeah,
and was happy to damage her. It's somewhat more controversial, but the intelligence agencies also concluded that ultimately he actually did want Trump to become president.
Scott Shane from the New York Times on the line. Just a couple more minutes with you, Scott, before I let you go. Did they then also spend $100,000, a pittance really, on ads on Facebook? And what do we know about those?
Well, Facebook announced yesterday, on Wednesday, that they had found 470 fake accounts and Facebook pages that they were able to track to a shadowy Russian company that calls itself the Internet Research Center, Internet Research Agency. And that, so they apparently created these fake accounts. And then the accounts were used to purchase $100,000 worth of Facebook advertising. And essentially what that does is it takes your posts and, you know, raises them in your news feed, your Facebook news feed, brings them to the attention of more people. So, you know, it was just sort of another logical thing you would do if you had an influence campaign going like this. you're right that $100,000 in Facebook world is not a whole lot. But it is, you know, but it's interesting they did it. Again, it seems to be a kind of...
it's a trial balloon, isn't it?
A kind of trial balloon, a kind of, you know, let's try everything and throw it up against the wall, see what sticks. And as I said, everyone certainly who looks at this from the U.S. government and from the experts outside the government think that the Russians will be back and probably with more sophisticated methods.
Well, now you got to just doubt everything. I mean, I don't know how we're going to know. I mean, so you've got the New York Times and the CNNs and the WGNs of the world. Maybe you trust those. Maybe it's a bogus version of that. But there's so many interesting arms of information out there, some of which are legitimate, but you and I aren't that familiar with. And then some of it may be bogus. I mean, Lord, we knew that the internet was filled with all sorts of informational booby traps, but now you really are kind of wondering what to believe going forward.
Absolutely, absolutely, yeah. I mean, it's very disorienting, and I think what's particularly disturbing to somebody like me who, you know, for most of my life, I'm old enough that for most of my life, there was no internet, and there wasn't even 24-hour cable, and so... you know, you had most people, you know, 30 years ago were coming to, you know, a local newspaper, maybe a national newspaper, maybe three networks, four networks, and everybody was getting the same set of facts. And then we could kind of duke it out over what the meaning of it was, and everybody could have different opinions. But now people really inhabit different information worlds, and I think it becomes much more difficult to have a sort of rational discussion when that's the truth.
Yeah. Well, and the thing that's just fascinating to me, too, is it sounds like sometimes they were putting out things that was not explicitly pro-Trump or pro-Clinton, but simply disruptive, say, about race issues or something like that. And if that foments unrest, then are they betting that we will gravitate towards one candidate as a result of that? Now, that's kind of an intriguing sort of calculus there, but I think that's pretty sophisticated if that's what they were up to.
Well, apart from whatever preference they may have had in the presidential election, I think a lot of people who study Putin's Russia would say that the kind of long-term overriding goal is to make the U.S. less of an attractive model for countries that have been historically in Russia's orbit. So the former Soviet republics, now independent countries, the Eastern countries in Eastern Europe, you know, they don't want those countries to fall under U.S. sway. So if the U.S. ends up looking like a very divided, very kind of dysfunctional country, the U.S. is much less attractive to Russia's neighbors, and it makes Putin very happy.
I'll visit with you again, but it's a fascinating read today, Scott. On Facebook and Twitter, A Hunt for Russia's Meddling Hand in the New York Times. Scott Shane, thanks for giving us some of your time.
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, really well done. Remember, if you don't already, today would be a good day to subscribe to a newspaper. Ro Khan, Anna DeVlantis in the studio. Ro, I hope you're able to actually do the show.
John, we were just talking about it during the break. You know how we've started this Ro Strong initiative here?
I've got one of the yellow Lance Armstrong-like bracelets on.
Mm-hmm. It's Ro Strong, WWRD. What will Ro do? I had another dentist appointment today, I believe that this is an act. I mean, Kevin understands this. He's the only one, actually, who does, and I think he's just sucking up. But
I think a little bit.
But understands that this is an act of incredible selflessness and bravery on my part.
It's an inspiration.
It is. Thank you.
Are we making donations to some foundation to support the Rokon?
No. No, I'm paying people to wear the braces. Totally opposite.
Give him a smack on the back of the head.
He was describing.
I drilled a tooth today without Novocaine.
Oh, that's pretty bad.
Two, as a matter of fact.
Why did they drill it without
Novocaine? Just shaving it down.
Because they just didn't want to give it to him.
Yeah. They wanted to hear me scream.
Well, at one point I was like, you know, you remember like when you're a kid and the dentist says, it's going to be okay. If you have any problem, just raise your hand and I'll stop.
Yes.
I'm raising my hand. Yeah. And he goes, are you trying to tell me that it hurts?
Yeah.
And I'm like, and he goes, don't worry about it. So almost over.
Are you sure you were at a dentist? Maybe you weren't at a real dentist.
Oh, no,
maybe
he's a real dentist. He's a dentist to the stomach.
Yeah, yeah,
we
okay.
don't use Novocaine. Yeah. Right.
Because my dentist uses Novocaine.
Mine does a lot of numbing.
He's got it in the waiting room. Just help yourself.
He does it normally, but I think he's fed up with me at this point.
Have a good show, Rokan.
Thank you.